So about 4 weeks before one passes on, they begin to see some entity. We'll be back with Dr. John Lerma on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Dr. John Lerma, his book, Into the Light. Tell me about this four-week visitation now, John.
Okay. Right at about 4 weeks, they'll see an entity, which a lot describe as a light entity. Very, very bright, in the shape of a human being, at times androgynous, long hair, blonde. They can even see the eyes, and at times just a human being, flesh and blood, wearing clothes, very delightful. But the one thing they all do not do is they do not communicate either ESP or verbally with them at that moment. They just sort of stand there. Usually pretty far away from the bed to the door, which as time goes on, they get closer. But and they last for about 3 to 4 seconds, is what I'm told.
Now, does the dying person realize this is an entity, or does he think it's a human being and, you know, he just came in the doorway and left?
They think they know it's something odd, but they think that they're hallucinating. When you finally get down to it and they trust you, they'll tell you that.
Who do you think this entity is, if it seems to be the same one?
Well, I don't know if it's so much the same one. I think they're just, they could be different ones, just all from God, coming to help the person, help them, guide them, review their life, and lead them into the next life.
It assumes then that this entity eventually comes back again?
Absolutely. After probably that first day, that first evening, usually in the evening hours, after the 3 or 4 seconds that they last, maybe in a couple of days they'll be back, and they're a little closer. Now they're further into the room. Patients learn on their own at this point, and this is what I've learned to tell my other patients. They'll eventually just go, "What do you want? What are you doing?"
Are they comfortable with the entity?
Absolutely. It emanates a lot of love, a lot of comfort. But just because they don't say anything, they get sort of just perturbed by that. And so they eventually, the patient will initiate the conversation, and that is what the entity wanted. Apparently, free will is very well respected on the other side.
Okay.
They don't get involved in other people's stuff like we do here. So once that conversation starts, then they can't stop that entity from talking, apparently. So it really views their life and sits down with them. And it's still short periods of time. But for the patient, they said it lasts like for days.
Well, does this entity say you're going to die soon and this is what we're doing?
Absolutely.
It does.
It describes what they're there for, that they are going to be leaving this world. It reminds them of... I hear pretty frequently, maybe about 80% of patients tell me that they take them sort of back into a memory before they were born, where we came from, and a decision they had made, and what lesson to choose here on Earth. And once they learn that, it helps them understand what it's all about and what they need to do to move forward.
This is one of those fascinating things I've ever heard, John. I've never heard this, and I've interviewed all of them, from Dr. Raymond Moody, all of them. I mean, this is the first time I've ever heard anything about this being that pops up.
Yeah, and you know, George, a lot of it is because no one really sat with these are pre-death experiences. A lot of people, Raymond Moody did a lot of the near-death. Well, that's what he does, the near-death. These people who died, left, and came back. Here, these people are awake and talking, and at the very end, you can actually, if they trust you, you can be talking to the patient and ask them questions to ask the entity, and they'll respond back to you with incredible answers.
Man, that is...
Yes, it really is really incredible, and I've just... So can you see how I'm learning a lot from them?
Yeah, absolutely.
They're teaching me.
Let me take a few moments, too, to ask you about when I had Whitley on. We were talking about some comments that you might have made toward the end of his program with Dreamland.
Yes.
Was there some kind of story that had to do with Roswell?
Absolutely. That was just not too long ago. In fact, living in Houston, and I also live in San Antonio, I'm just contracting with many hospices now. But the one in Houston really attracts because of MD Anderson Hospital, which is probably now the largest cancer institute in the world. So people from all over the place, all over the world, come there to find the cure. And so I'm talking, from everywhere, Saudi Arabia. So you'll have kings there and queens, down to the janitor. And so I frequently get to talk to people who have had really incredible lives. And one in particular was this gentleman who is from New Mexico. He was in his late 80s and lived there at the time during the Roswell crash, and actually was friends with Matt Brazel. What he told me was sort of interesting, yeah. Pretty incredible. And I'm going to put that story, I think he wanted me to write that story, and I'm going to put that story in my second book. But what I can tell you that he did tell me, and this man did see the angels at the end and so forth, but he needed a lot of reassurance from them because of what had happened at Roswell. He was that July, and what was it, July in 47, July 4th or so, that evening, he did corroborate there was a storm, and the next day his friend Matt Brazel did what we heard, but he did go and talk to other friends, and he spoke to him, and he invited him over. He says, "You've got to come see this stuff." And so he did, and it was strewn all over. There were a lot of pieces, but he said there was also parts of a craft, not the second craft, that there were still parts of a major craft in that original debris site. And in that craft, they saw, George, and this is interesting, a German swastika, the German sign.
Isn't that interesting?
Okay, and
oh,
now you tell me. So this guy, this gentleman, and his wife corroborated that as well. And so they, when the soldiers all came in and started talking and telling everybody to be quiet, that they told Matt Brazel that you didn't see that this was a German vehicle or craft.
That was a couple years after the war ended, though.
Absolutely, and which is what was even more important, that they kept it quiet. Can you imagine that if there was a German, we know that the Germans, I had physics background as a physicist. We knew they were working on anti-gravity and these objects. And apparently these Foo Fighters were really, that they were seen during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there was a bunch of them, but we believe now, a scientist, that it was Hitler's. Hitler and the scientists had developed these crafts. And we know the names of them were the Honeyboo 1 and the Honeyboo 2. You can actually, it's all over the internet. You can actually find all the information about that. And so where did these scientists go after the war? They left and worked with the United States because they weren't going to work. Well, they were going to probably be killed by Russia.
Right. Well, if you went to Russia, they got taken, didn't they?
Yes, but they were going to kill them because they had killed so many of their people. And, Hitler was horrific to what he did to the Russian people. So apparently, this gentleman that it took care of did become a physicist. He did work. He did do some work there in New Mexico. Never really told me where. We really didn't get around to it. He just really started getting pretty sick pretty fast. But I got the meat of it, and that was that the scientists that he did speak to were already speaking with the United States probably a year before the war ended, knowing that the war was going to end.
Mm-hmm.
They were looking for asylum. They didn't want to be killed by the Russians.
Right, right.
So where did he go? Now this is what I thought was really interesting. They were taken, most of them initially, to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where the big project was being taken care of, or where they were doing projects on foreign whatever foreign object that from other governments they had found, they were just looking at them. But that's where they did their studies, and they commenced their studies. And whatever they had left off in Germany, they continued over here at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And apparently the deal they made with Russia, the United States made with Russia when Russia took over Berlin, was, okay, what are you going to take? What are we going to take from this whole thing?
Right.
They didn't take Berlin, but, you can take certain scientists. We'll take certain scientists. And they gave them the combustion engine, which the Russians eventually turned into the MiG fighter. And for those who don't know, the combustion engine was developed by the Germans. These scientists were so intelligent. And that's where we developed our jets from. So here's the United States giving Russia what they thought was a really good deal, the MiG. So here we go, and we take the scientists who were doing studies on anti-gravity and other things, and fiber optics and so forth. And so they continued that. And not only did they do that, but they apparently broke down a lot of those, I guess they're disc craft, and they shipped them over to the United States, eventually to Wright-Patterson.
And they were all German?
All German. And the ones that he told me. And I think Dr. Meath, he even gave me some names. M-I-E-T-H-E, I think, was one of them. There was a couple of other names. I haven't written them, of scientists he spoke with. But they were being just worked like animals there. They didn't really have a lot of rights. The NSA was really over them. I think the NSA at that point had developed. And then they started to farm them out to industrial complexes. So thus began the military-industrial complex.
I wonder if this also created the secret space program.
You know what? All of that initially started. But slowly, Colonel Curso, he said, John, that gentleman, he has, when he wrote that book, he goes, part of it's true and part of it's not. Colonel Curso, he told me, by him, it was part of the plan for him to write this book. The government does eventually want to tell us about this. It's just not time. They do have the technology. It's just incredible. These machines that are flying out there, here in Texas, being in Texas, this last flight of all these, discs and large objects that are about a mile long, in Stephenville, remember that?
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. Absolutely. We've been following that. Hey, let me also ask you, though, the symbols that some witnesses have always reported with the Roswell wreckage was strange, almost like hieroglyphs.
Okay. Yes. I asked him, what about these aliens that they saw?
Yeah, the
three or four. I go, what was that about? So if you did see the German craft, was that us? And he goes, absolutely. What it was a craft that went down, radar, like they had said, that was just large numbers around that nuclear area, highly secure area, because that's where the atomic bomb was being, or they had transferred the atomic bomb from the Enola Gay there. In Roswell. So, the radar apparently disrupted the electromagnetic forces in that craft, and it crashed. But that was one of ours. They were already starting to fly it. And as you know, George, a month before that...
Why didn't they paint the swastika off that?
Well, it was one of theirs, probably still. I don't think they painted it. I think it was one of the ones they transferred over. Remember they broke them down and brought them over?
Yeah.
And so can you imagine... Here, the war's over. They see a swastika on this craft that's highly technologically advanced next to a nuclear, armament area that's supposedly secure. How would that look?
Okay, and again, what about the bodies?
So the bodies, here's the deal. So they were apparently flying, and this is where he said he wasn't quite sure, but that the scientists were saying they were working together, and that is where the Nazis had developed, that they were one of the first people to connect with these aliens. and they got a lot of their technology from that. So, yes.
Ah, so they
were flying together and apparently struck each other and hit. And, you know, the one we had crashed, and the alien one went forward and crashed as well. So, yes, there was some aliens there. He did not see them, but Matt Brazel did see them. And he said, I don't think Matt Brazel would be lying, but he said they weren't crash dummies from that mogul secret balloon that they had. There's no doubt that they were small aliens. He said they were very thin, sort of a lot like what the Whitley describes as the grays.
You're just full of incredible stories tonight,
well,
John.
Well, I'm telling you, when you're taking care of people who are dying, they will tell you a lot of confessions on their deathbed. And, you know, and as Whitley and I talked about, we also talked about another gentleman who knew about the Kennedy assassination. And just a lot of really interesting things that I guess I have to be careful about, too, so describing. But I thought that was really, and it made a lot of sense to me as to why the government did what they did there then. And that they did plan, that this was all planned, not at that moment, General Blanchard decided, hey, we would need to remove that article from the newspaper and say it's a balloon. Apparently, they already had been working on some kind of a plan as to what to do to say, because people were already seeing all these things a month before. There were millions of people that had reported seeing this. So what are they going to do? So they were working on that project and in terms of the psychology of it. How are we going to deal with this in the future? Because we're going to be flying these things around, you know. And so they came up with a lot of things, and they came up with this flying saucer bit, and they made it a subject of ridicule. And it's worked, pretty much. It's a lot of disinformation and so forth.
I got to tell you, connection between what you've done and the field you're in, it's wide open, isn't it?
Well, it is wide open, and you know, George, I believe that there's no coincidences in life. I think things connect us to what we're supposed to do.
Fate, and I really fate does incredible things.
And Whitley and I were supposed to meet, and that really got me into understanding and where we're at, and that we're not alone. And not just that patient who saw who was at Roswell. George, I asked many of them patients, are there people in other planets? Are there people in other galaxies?
What did they say?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They absolutely, you know, they just go, are you stupid? Are you stupid, Dr. Of course, you know, the same matter during the Big Bang, the same matter went out in all directions that created us. And that, yes, there is a supreme being. There is intelligence. But there are people that are more advanced than us, and there are people that are not. And that they are coming here to help us. And there are some dark figures as well, just like us. But all in all, we're supposed to figure a way to get along in the future, to share our technology and so forth.
When we
race and other planets, my patients say, have their problems, and they need us as well to help them.
The entity that makes the visitations, when we talked about 4 weeks and we got it down, there are even more visitations, aren't there?
Yeah, they keep coming about every other day, and they start talking.
Until you die?
And yes.
All right, I want you, when we come back, pick up from where and what happens when we die. And then I want you to tell us about this incredible story of Matthew that you share with us in the book. We'll be back. And our guest, Dr. John Lermer, next hour we'll open up the phone lines. We'll take some of your incredible stories that you perhaps experienced yourself, your near-death experiences. John, tell us about the story of Matthew that you highlight.
One of the most, probably the story that's dear to my heart, story of a 9-year-old boy with a cancer, but name of retinoblastoma, which is an incurable cancer that starts in the retina of the eye.
Oh, my gosh. Horrible.
And, oh, yeah, it was just quite horrible. And his progressed, and they enucleated his first eye around probably about the age of 7 or 8. That means to remove the eye, literally. And they put a prosthesis in. Probably about 4 months later, it spread to the second eye, and they removed the second eye. So this boy, by the age of 8 and a half or so, was blind. And soon thereafter, the tumor started to protrude from his right temporal region. Probably the size of like a baseball initially. Or a softball, rather. I was asked to take care of this. This was really not my patient initially, but I was asked to take care of it by the pediatrician who did not show up that day. Mm-hmm. And, like, things are just, there's no coincidences. I walk in, I'd read this the chart and this little boy being blind, and I had heard incredible stories already about this little sage full of wisdom and knowledge. And I walked in, and I'd heard that he could see, okay, and from some of the nurses at MD Anderson. And so I walked in, and I purposely looked toward, he was in his bed, and towards the other side was his sister, and I looked at her, and I go, "Are you Matthew?" Purposely doing that to see if he'd know I was doing that. And he quickly shouts out, he goes, "No, you silly. Look this way. I'm Matthew." Well, with not being able to see, and immediately he goes, "So you're the Dr. Lerma." He goes, "I love that coat you have and that blue shirt you have on." Just started to describe everything I had, and I'm going, "What's going on?"
Yeah, how does he do this? Yeah.
What's going on here? And so I just sort of went along with the whole thing initially, and I was really, really skeptical about this, thinking maybe his mom had told him or so forth. But, shortly thereafter, I really realized this boy was the real thing. He was dying. He was seeing angels, three angels to be exact. Their names were Raffi, that he called them Noe, and Gaby. And
Raphael, Linda.
Yeah, I guess. And I just, I told him, "Is that like Archangel Gabriel and Raphael?" "I don't know about Noe." And he goes, "I guess. I don't know." He goes, "They're pretty big." And he was just a delightful boy. I met him when he walked in, he came into our inpatient unit, which is usually the last stop for most patients. They usually have horrendous pain or some kind of symptom that's needing aggressive management. He did not have any of those symptoms. And I asked him, "Why do you really want to be here, Matthew?" And he goes, "Because I know the angels are telling me I have less than 2 weeks to live, and I don't want to put my mom through that at home."
You know, you said something, too, when he said they're pretty big. As you know, we've done a lot of shows on giants, visitations from giants. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. I wonder if they truly were of gigantic size and stature.
He described them. He said they would change, not size-wise, but colors, depending on how his mood was. That if he was sad, they would be sad as well, and he could see their color with them. That's what he said. But immediately they would try to change that had their color to try to emanate some that peace they were getting. From what he said was God. Okay, everything comes from the source. He goes, everything comes from God. He goes, all the energy. And that it would emanate and it would radiate towards him and make him feel better. But he said when he looked at them, it's like as though the ceiling didn't exist because they were so tall. Probably just another dimension of sorts. But when he would look at the wall and ceiling, they were much taller than the ceiling. The ceilings were about 12 feet, the walls were about 12 feet in height.
You had said it. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. And and they would all come at the same time, very loving and comforting, and they would come usually on his Fridays is chemotherapy day. And this was the first patient that had that I experienced that had started to see these angels way before the 4 weeks. In fact, he had been seeing them for about a year or 2 years.
You had said earlier that you didn't believe there was a hell. Yet do any of these people see hell or the devil or anything like that?
Well, you know, I asked Matthew, you know.
The kid.
Yes, Matthew's a kid. I go, what about evil? Is there such a thing? And he quoted, he goes, there are bad things in the world, but we are all responsible and we can change it. And that is the goal of God and our goal, too. To make the changes, God told me we just have to believe in him and goodness and love and forgiveness and in ourselves. But it does exist, and it exists within all of us. And he went on to say it's not an actual place. Because the other side, he goes, Dr. Lerman, it's spiritual. It's not like material that you can touch, he said. But you can make anything happen, and you can dream anything, and it occurs. So he said what most people do at the very end, and I learned that after that. I started to see more and more patients, and I understood why these patients who were dying without forgiving themselves, how that was hell. Because those are the people, these people who murder people who can't forgive themselves, and there's a story in the book about that, a patient like that, will have a hard time if no one is around them that is loving. And most of the time, these people that are murderers or heroin addicts and so forth are already condemned, in a sense, by their family and by their genetics. And he told me it carried on. And, you know, some religions, especially the Christian religion, believes in what's called generational sin. And so I asked him, so is that, like, passed on our genetics? This little kid really was so smart, was able to communicate in these incredible vocabulary, although he told me that he was just telling me what the angels were telling him. But he said that the angels told him, please let everybody know there's no hell the way we're being taught, and that it was very upsetting to God that our preachers, that the teachers of religion are teaching that they are making God out to be who they are, who we are as humans, not who we are, not like him, rather.
Did anybody?
And I thought that was really big. I thought that was a big thing.
Did anybody talk of reincarnation?
Yes, absolutely. You know, George, they just, anything's possible. Anything is possible, and
true.
Yes, you can reincarnate into this world if you'd like. And in fact, Matthew said that he was reincarnated in here to come back to help his mom find God. And basically, not just to find God. When they say to find God, it's to find, because they say God lives within you, it's to find who you are, to define who you are, and to redefine, to find that person that loves yourself. And that's what he was doing, and he did. And he goes, and Dr. Lerma, I promise you, my mom will find herself. And he gave me the day he would die on a Monday, like late afternoon, and he said it would happen when his mom found herself and loved herself, that he would die the next day, and it would be a Monday. And sure enough, he died on Monday about 6 p.m. His mom did end up accepting his illness and accepting God and really coming out and telling him, you know, son, I really love you, and I had been feeling sorry for myself, and I've learned a lot from you. And so he told me to come in and see him before he passed. He died peacefully. He went to sleep. And the last words he said, he goes, I'll be back to see you when it's your day. He goes, you'll die from an illness, but not from cancer.
What's the message that you truly want to get out in the book, Into the Light?
It's a message of love, forgiveness, non-condemnation, non-judgment, that we do continue to live. It is so real, George. You would just literally, if people are ever in San Antonio, Houston, you know, please have them call me. I'll take them with me to see this stuff. I just feel I've been honored to be able to sit with these patients, take the time to have them tell me. But that is the message. It's the message of self-love, self-forgiveness, because that's the key. And it is a hard thing. We're not going to get it perfect, they said. But if you can try, just try every day to just be good to yourself and to go have fun. Don't feel bad if you're having fun and someone else isn't. Everyone's responsible for who they are. And once you can do that, then you'll be good for everyone else. But if you try to be good to other people and don't love yourself, it really doesn't count.
Where do you get the book, Into the Light?
It's really, I think it's at all bookstores, Barnes & Noble, and Amazon.com is probably the easiest place to get it. Just go on the internet and bring up Amazon.com and plug Into the Light. Or you can go onto my website, drjohnlerma.com, and it'll lead you into Amazon.com. And I also have an email in there. I've had people just email me, asking me questions about family members who are passing, and I answer all my emails and give them some advice.
Are you afraid of dying?
Not at all. I'm afraid of, I will say this, I'm not afraid of dying. I'm afraid that someone won't be there to give me comfort, because many, many doctors and many nurse, our health professionals, even family members, are scared to move forward to help you find comfort. They feel that they're killing you if they give you morphine. I think that is just the silliest thing. We treat our animals so much better, George. Someone sees an animal hurting on the street, they'll pick it up, they'll take it to the vet. They know they're going to die. Please put him out of his misery. But when it comes to human beings, we'll let someone suffer in a vegetative state for years and years. And that is just horrific. That's what I'm scared of.
Dr. Gary Schwartz, you'd mentioned that he's done some work in this field. He's been on the program before. Do you contact these people? Are you in touch with them, or are you out there all by yourself?
No. I've contacted George. I've had dinner with Bruce Grayson. But, you know, we're also busy. But, we're all occasionally just sending out emails, letting each other know what they're doing and how their research is going and so forth. But mine, and we're all connecting in such a way that, like, Dr. Schwartz is just really connecting with people, these mediums, really just trying to understand where they're coming from, that portion. Dr. Bruce Grayson is more of the actual tangible procedures, looking at certain chemicals in the brain, trying to figure out what it is, what chemical it is that is inciting these events. For me, a lot of it is just I'm doing the whole human connection. I'm sitting down with my patients, touching them, loving them, and getting these stories. And so together as a group, collectively, I think we're all doing a good job. But George, we need, like you, to keep telling people, we need everybody to connect. And I have this foundation that I'm really trying to get started. It's called Hearts Without Borders.
And what is that?
It's a foundation to really just to educate, to get people to understand life through dying, how to live life through understanding death. And I really want to lobby Congress and to get the whole idea of death and dying and teaching it in our schools, probably starting in seventh grade. We teach sex education. We teach all this other stuff that really, it's okay. And we teach about life, pediatrics, OB-GYN, but nothing about what's really going to happen to every single one of us, and that's death and dying. You know, we're all talking about cryogenics, what we can do to live longer. Maybe they'll find something to bring us back. Well, you know what? That's what reincarnation is for.
Yeah.
You know, it really is silly, and America's probably one of the only nations out there that doesn't talk about death.
Have you ever talked to
everyone else?
Have you ever talked to Raymond Moody?
No.
And you would thoroughly enjoy him.
I would love to talk to him. I know he's been really busy, and maybe one of these days that'll happen.
He's been on the program numerous times.
Yeah. Well, I had a real quick question, George.
Sure.
What do you feel, George? I mean, what's your feeling about death, about your own death? I mean, are you scared as well?
I've learned that there is something on the other side. Honestly, the one thing of death that kind of perplexes me or bothers me is, you know, I'm the kind of person, John, I want to know everything about everything,
you know,
and if God forbid I'm dying, I want to know it in advance, and I want to know what I can do to fight it or what I can do to prepare for it.
Absolutely.
The one thing that I guess in saying the word fear isn't the right word because I'm not.
Right.
But concerned about, I guess, is you go to bed one day and you don't wake up.
Absolutely.
That would bother me.
Right.
You know, I don't want to just wake up in this other existence if that's indeed what happens.
Right.
I want to know, you know, George, you're going. You know, you got 6 months, you got 12 months, you got 10 years, whatever it is.
I hear you, George.
And that's what I want when it comes to death. I believe there's something on the other side.
Right.
But I don't want this sudden stuff.
Well, and you know what, George? The latest anecdotal evidence or studies I'm doing and interviews are with people who probably more than 6 months. I'm really hitting them earlier now. And even people who aren't even sick that just sort of show up through the emergency room, just general patients. And I have to say that a lot of people now that I'm probably of the 600 I've interviewed so far, 400 of them who passed on probably from heart attacks and strokes, were a little older. They said that they started to have dreams. They knew that their death was coming, and we've heard stories like that, George, where the family member goes and gets this insurance, which the wife said, that's really bizarre.
Yeah.
He never really talked about that. And he gets it a few weeks later. He passes away in a car accident. Well, it's those patients I think I'm starting to hit on that they say that they are communicating, that they are being told, George. And so I do believe we are all told. I think just people don't tell other people. And maybe it's not that important. I feel it is important, George, like you. I would like to know.
Yeah.
And I think we just got to open ourselves, George. And I think what you're doing on the show is just incredible, keeping people's minds open. You know, have you heard of that molecule, DMT, that book called The God Molecule?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, that molecule now in the pineal gland, that center gland that no one knew what it was about. They thought it's right in the center of the brain, it housed the soul. Well, it probably does to a certain extent. But DMT, it's like, and you know this, it's a lot like, not like LSD, rather.
It's a hallucinogen.
That's right. And people who are doing it now do get to see like this, the whole spiritual thing, but it's fearful for them. Because it's not done in the right context. However, I do think that God created our whole body, engineered it so perfect that in the end it would provide so much opiates, this DMT molecule, to bring our neurons together, all firing for the first time 100%. That PET scan, I never told you this, that PET scan of a person having a vision, George, was lit. The whole brain was yellow and red.
All right, stay with us, John. We're going to take phone calls when we come back.